Okay, it's 9 o'clock on my screen, so I will start. I do have a lot I want to do, but I'm going to hold off maybe till next week, responding to some of your questions and comments, only because I don't know if we'll finish Ben Amozov today, but I do want to finish him by the beginning of next class and move on to Rabbi Joseph Nassas. I just want to mention three things, and then we'll immediately begin. First, for those who were on last night, Bill Gewirtz had a very successful class. I don't just mean in terms of the quality of the class itself, but there was, when I was on, 36 people on listening, which is certainly a lot. There's still two more classes coming, so I encourage everyone to sign up. It is free, and you'll find it very interesting. Also, thank you to Shlomo for pointing out I misspoke last week when I was speaking about tekiyas and the hefsek. I actually meant that once you finish the tekiyas in the davening, in the Shmona Esrei, the tekiyas to Me'umad, which some people do it in silent Shmona Esrei, others do it in the repetition, then you're finished both your biblical obligation, which you finish at the beginning in the initial blasts, and you also finish the rabbinic. The 40 at the end are simply minhags. So that's what I was referring to when I said I don't know any justification to not speaking until the end of those ones. Look, I'm sure there's some sefer that says it's also an inyan not to do that. I do not believe I know the Yemenites don't do the end. When I say I know, I've been told the Yemenites don't do extra 40 at all, but maybe someone can confirm it. I also, just because I'll take 1 minute, someone sent me this short video of 1 minute. He thought it illuminated some things I said, so I will play it for you right now. What it illuminates is as follows. I've mentioned a number of times the significance of Rav Avadya Yosef. In fact, there's been talk, he just turned 90 years old, and there's been talk in the Israeli newspapers now about what's going to be the future of Shas. Rav Avadya can't be a leader forever. And there's all sorts of thought that maybe it'll fall apart, different segments will open up. And the major attraction of Shas has been not the Haredim, but has been to the Sephardic community as a whole. And I've distinguished many times between Rav Avadya Yosef as a leader of all of Jewish people, that is, one who's concerned with the irreligious person at the development town, all this. And I contrasted that to the Haredi Ashkenazic leaders, who are really sectarian leaders, and that their only concern is for their own small community. They don't have any of this broader concern. I mean, the Ger Rebbe doesn't even speak to people if they're not Shomer Shabbos. So let me show you now a video of Rav Avadya Yosef, who I know, he makes crazy statements and things like that, but to get a sense of why the Israeli population as a whole, especially the Sephardic population, looks up towards him, even if they're just Masorati or even less than that. Look at this video, and while you're watching it, while he's meeting with soccer players who don't even know how to dress when they come to see the Gadol Hador, with jeans and everything, and you see the love and the connection they have, and just think of the Ashkenazic Gadolim, Rav Yosher, Rav Chaim Kanievsky, never in a million years would they ever do anything like this. And this shows Rav Avadya Yosef, although he has, people say he's been Ashkenazified to a certain extent, fundamentally he's still from the old Sephardic tradition, a rabbi of the people, not just of the Orthodox or the scholars. So I'm going to play this just a minute for you. There's a much longer video that I found on YouTube, about 7 minutes you can watch and you can listen to Rav Avadya speak, but this is just, I think it's even just 52 seconds, you get a sense. So let me pull this up right now. Okay, so there you get a sense of what I'm speaking about. Okay, I want to now move on to more with Rabbi Elie ben Amozik, because there's a lot I want to do. He does that to everyone. That's apparently his shtick, or maybe it's an Iraqi shtick, but he's into the slapping of the face. So Yisrael, if you don't want to get your face slapped, don't go visit him. One more comment I want to respond to before we start with Rabbi ben Amozik. Last class I spoke about Shaddal's opposition to the Zohar. I mentioned Yehuda Aryeh Nimodna and how they also were opposed to Kabbalah. And I also referred to Rav Yaakov Emden, who wrote criticisms of Zohar. So someone wrote to me, and I think maybe his error is the same as some of you were thinking the same thing, so let me explain. Rav Yaakov Emden, unlike Shaddal and Yehuda Aryeh Nimodna, was a great believer in Kabbalah. He was a Mekubal. It was just the Zohar, he thought, was full of forgeries and later interpolations. But just like Ben Amozig said, that Kabbalah does not depend on the Zohar, Rabbi Yaakov Emden thought the same thing. He was attacking the Zohar because of he was a great lover of Kabbalah, and he thought that this was a distortion. Look, the Ramban didn't have the Zohar. Asa Mekubalim didn't have the Zohar. So don't make the mistake of thinking that Rabbi Yaakov Emden had something against Kabbalah. His only criticisms were against the Zohar. And if you take him at his word, right at the beginning of his book, he's not opposed to the Zohar per se. He thinks that there is a section of it that does go back to antiquity. He just thinks, though, that there's been numerous additions made, interpolations, forgeries, all sorts of things. Whether you take that literally is a question, because I have a friend who's written a sefer, a commentary on Rav Yaakov Emden, and he doesn't really believe this to be the case. He thinks Rav Yaakov Emden just says this, but if you read his work, where he goes page after page, how this could not really be authentic, he doesn't believe any of it's authentic. But whatever the case may be, he is not an opponent of Kabbalah. On the contrary, he's the greatest advocate of Kabbalah, Rav Yaakov Emden. And I already mentioned that the Chasam Sofer is also a great, great advocate of Kabbalah, states that if you took what was authentic in the Zohar versus what are later interpolations, the Zohar will be a very small book. Returning to Ben Amozig, we ended last class. I'm going to tell you that about the controversy over cremation that Ben Amozig was involved in. And I mentioned that this is how we ended last class, that you had rabbis arguing that there is nothing wrong with cremation. And if you look in the Talmud, you don't see any prohibition on it. In fact, if you look in the end of the book of Samuel, you see 1 Samuel, you see that the bodies of Samuel and his sons were burnt by the Jews. So how can you prohibit cremation? Now, there was a similar dispute in Germany at the very same time, or even a little before. You had all these people arguing that Jews should be cremated. What's with the cremation thing? Well, first of all, there was a health concern. Throughout all of German society, as well as in Italian society, it was thought that it was more hygienic. There was a fear of being near a rotten corpse. Burning the body was thought to be more appropriate, elegant. The non-Jews were cremating their bodies. And this influenced the Jews. Remember how I spoke when we did our class on Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan, that Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan banned the practice of dragging the bodies to the cemetery. That was a form of kapara because of how it looked to the non-Jews. Well, you see that if the non-Jews, if the non-Jewish society was moving as the way to go, so Jewish society also. And Amozig wrote a book about this. Remember I said that there were rabbis who were arguing this. So Ben Amozig published a book. Here it is, Yaneh Ba'esh. He wrote it and he distributed it, I'm sure, but it only appeared after his death. His sons published it. And he argues that the verse in Genesis, "You are dust, and to dust you will return," teaches us that burial in the ground is a commandment for all of humanity, and the basis is the obligation to follow God's will. It is not a specific mitzvah of the 613. However, it is God's wishes, so in that sense, it's a mitzvah, because the Torah says you will return to dust. The only exception is that when someone is stoned, then there's a specific mitzvah to bury him. But other than that, there's no specific mitzvah, but it is in accord with God's will, so it's one of these overarching things that call it, but God's will, which you should do, even if it's not an explicit mitzvah. And it also says at the end of Devarim that Hashem buries Moshe. So from that, Ben Amozig argues, you might think it's a little weak. Oh, these are not explicit mitzvot. Rabbi's arguing that if it's not forbidden, then by definition it must be permitted. That is, if it's not forbidden in the Gemara, or in the Torah, and the early codifiers, then it must be permitted. And Ben Amozig said no, that you have this other category of where we have to do these things, even though they're not technical mitzvot. You can make a case from this that there's a lot of things we do that are not technically mitzvot, but we know we have to do them. That's what Ben Amozig was saying. Yet what happens if someone does cremate a body? He says that nevertheless you do bury it in the cemetery, and you don't make a special place in the cemetery for those who are cremated, because this will give the practice legitimacy. In Germany, this was a great dispute. Adam Furziger has a lengthy article that will be appearing I should say soon, but it will be appearing on this big dispute, because most of the rabbis in Germany saw this as a reform practice and as a way of combating it. They argue that it is forbidden to bury the ashes of a cremated person in a Jewish cemetery. It's a gezeira that we make, that we refuse to bury them, to show that this is unacceptable. There was an opposing position led by the Rav of Munich, Rabbi Ehrentrau, who argued that, no, you do bury them, but we'll make a separate place to bury them, just like the suicides will bury in a separate place. And in the olden days, we would bury certain sinners there. He thought that if we're burying Shabbos violators and all these other sinners in our cemeteries, and these are biblical prohibitions, certainly you can bury someone who cremates themselves. And although technically, if you're burying a Shabbos violator with everyone else, you could bury the ashes of a cremation victim also. His point was that with the Shabbos violators, we can't do this anymore. That is, the community will not support us making a separate place to bury them. But since the community as a whole is pretty outraged by cremation, at least in this area, we can still uphold the notion that real sinners and people who cremate their bodies are showing, it was thought, that they don't believe in a resurrection. They're breaking the Jewish tradition. So since we can bury them in a separate place, that's what we should do. But we should bury them, unlike the argument, and most rabbis in Germany. A book was published about this by Rabbi Meir Lerner of Altona. Most rabbis of Germany agreed that as a Migdar Milta, as an emergency measure, we refuse to bury someone who's cremated in a Jewish cemetery. You have other examples of Migdar Milta. This has been a practice of the rabbis. Rabbi Soloveitchik speaks about it, one of the famous rabbinic conferences where they voted not to allow, if a father does not circumcise his son, then this family, including the son, cannot be a member of the community. And the Rav says that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik disagreed with this. He thought, okay, so they commit one sin, but that doesn't mean that they, where do we find that if you don't circumcise your son that you're not members of the community, just that you're sinning? And Rav Soloveitchik says that from a purely halachic standpoint, Rav Chaim was right, but the other rabbis were right in terms of the Jewish community as a whole. It was a very interesting passage, because he's acknowledging that, in this case at least, he would have sided with the other rabbis. I don't know. Maybe someone can tell me, who's listening, what the practice is today. Will, if a cemetery in America will bury a cremation, ashes from a cremated victim, I have no idea. I would think they would, because how many cemeteries in America are controlled by the community? In Europe, the community had a cemetery, and if it was an Orthodox controlled community, you know, if the Reform were in charge, then they do what they want. But if in many communities the Orthodox were in control, and even when the Orthodox weren't in control, you had Orthodox communities with their own cemetery often. So they can make their own rules. Today, communities don't make the rules. Cemeteries are privately owned. So I'm sure there's still a few in America that are owned by Orthodox shuls and they can do what they want. But most cemeteries are owned their businesses. So I guess they'll bury whoever they want. They'll bury, if you give them the ashes, they'll bury the ashes. But I'm curious, in the cemeteries that are still owned by Orthodox either shuls, communal organizations, what they do with ashes. I don't know. If anyone knows, you can let me know. However, in Rome, in 1911, the chief rabbi, I mentioned this already, Yitzhak Castiglione, dies, and at his wishes, he is cremated, and he is buried in the Jewish cemetery, and you can go to the Rome Jewish Cemetery today and see his grave. haven't been there, but he's the chief rabbi. You'll be able to find him very easily. He was of the opinion that today this is a practice that should be adopted. I know it's hard to imagine that a rabbi having his body cremated. He obviously didn't accept Ben Amozik's position. Okay, now what I want to move on and discuss briefly Ben Amozik's most important work. I have a picture of it. That's a book about him that just came out. Israel and Humanity, translated into English not too long ago. Translated to Hebrew many years before, and it hasn't been translated again by Rabbi Zaini, but it will be. This is published actually by Paulist Press. They have a series called Classics of Western Spirituality. Paulist Press also published one of Rabbi Soloveitchik's books. Pinchas Peli's work on repentance is published by Paulist Press. In this book, this is what makes Ben Amozik so interesting and significant for people today, why there's been a revival of interest in him in the last 10, 15 years. He explains how Jews are supposed to relate to the world. And because his perspective is so different than what you hear, generally, maybe in some liberal Orthodox segments you'll hear it, but certainly not in the mainstream Orthodox or the Haredi world, because it's so different, that's what makes it, I think, significant. His argument in this book is that we have a special task, but the non-Jews also have a task. And their task is not to serve the Jews or anything like that. And their task is seen through their following of the Noahide Code. Ben Amozik is the first one to speak about the Noahide Code in anything other than generalities. His student, who we'll speak about maybe today, if not, we'll do it at the beginning of next class, Palier, is the first Noahide in history, at least the first Noahide that we know of. I don't mean someone who follows the Noahide laws. I mean someone who has a Noahide consciousness. I don't know of any other examples. Maybe there were some. But none of them have left records. And what a story. I will tell you this story. Ben Amozik stresses in this book. It's a long book. It's about 300 pages. And it has an appendix by Moshe Idel on Kabbalah in Ben Amozik, translated by a man named Luria, who's translated from the French. His argument, basically, is that Jews are not supposed to be so particularistic that they do not see the value of other peoples in the world. But throughout the book, there are such original readings of biblical texts, of Talmudic texts, of Kabbalistic ideas, it makes it really fascinating. He also addresses Christians in this book to show them that in Judaism, you find the beginnings of universal religion. That's the major theme, that there's Judaism and that there's universal religion. And he says to the Christians that this universal religion is going to help purify your own religion because Christianity has been corrupted theologically. And he also deals with the non-religious, that is, the atheists. Now, as part of the Italian milieu, it is not unexpected to find him speaking of the beauty of certain passages in the Gospels. He also speaks of truth found in other religions. I'm going to read you a section, but let me get back to what I just said about the beauty of certain passages in the Gospel. There are some wonderful passages in the Gospel, and I think for basically every one of them, you can find Jewish parallels. Ben Amozik, in his book Jewish and Christian Ethics that I've spoken about, and we're going to get back to it later today, takes pretty much every single great passage in the New Testament and shows a parallel in the Talmud or the Midrashic literature. Show even Turn Your Other Cheek that I mentioned before. I said, I'm sure you can find a passage like that. He's able to find a passage showing that everything good in the, I guess to coin a phrase that was said about another book, Mashe Chadash Eino Chidush. That is, what is new in the New Testament, or what people think is new, is not a chidush, because the Jews said it first. Uma chidush Eino Tov. And what's a chidush there, what's novel in the New Testament, is not good. I think it's an interesting and important perspective, because Jews often... Jews, because of our history and our experience with the church, we're reluctant to see anything good, anything positive, let's say, in the New Testament, even if these are Jewish ideas that are found there. We'll easily quote a text from another religion, maybe from Buddhism or Taoism, but if it's from a Christian text, that's automatically problematic. And yet there are some very fine ideas in these texts, which, as I mentioned, can find parallels and from Ben Amozig's understanding come directly from Judaism, which is understandable. This comes out of a Jewish background. With the exception of Luke, we think that all the gospel writers come out of a Jewish background. But it is a little off-putting, perhaps, to hear a rabbi say some of the things he says. Let me quote. Here's a passage speaking about Kabbalah. Kabbalah regards the long sojourn of the Hebrews in Egypt as a means used by divine providence to restore to the religion of Israel, to incorporate it in it through selective process all that was good and true in the Egyptian religion. It points out the resemblances between the words Mitzrayim, Egypt, and Mitzarim, frontiers or limits, to indicate that Egypt was the nearest country to Palestine, not only geographically, but also from a religious perspective. He argues that ancient Egypt had Jewish, that is, ancient Kabbalistic ideas from this universal religion going back to Abraham, and therefore when we see similarities, and we see even, as I'll mention, that God commands the Jews to do practices that were being done in Egypt. This is simply returning, or restoring is the word he uses, through divine providence, of what was universal religion now being particularized. So it's not paganism. He's a very interesting perspective on it. I'll get back to this in a minute. He can say this. I'm sure if you got up and said it in your shul, they'd stone you. He can say this because the essence of Kabbalah is to be found in ancient religions. And I'm going to bring proofs of this from him in a few minutes. So the connection continues from the ancient pagan religion to modern religions. And why is this so important? Because he sees this as fundamental to the Torah that Noahidism, that is the religion of Noah, universal religion, be established. Jews have to be involved. Remember we spoke last class that Jews are the Kohanim. They're the priests of the world. What does that mean? That means that they are the go-betweens. Their job is to disseminate true religion and morality. So it was Ben Amozig that developed the notion of Jewish Noahidism. You go online, you plug in Seven Laws of Noah, anything like that, you'll find Ben Amozig front and center, the Society of Noahides. They have excerpts from Ben Amozig's writings. The Lubavitcher Rebbe got onto this Noahide kick, in, I guess, in the 70s or maybe even a little in the 80s, because President Reagan declared Noahide Law Day. But Ben Amozig is the first one to develop a theory and an approach and really think of it in practical terms. What do I mean by that? Yes, you had rabbis that spoke about the seven laws of Noah, that non-Jews need to observe the seven laws of Noah. But Ben Amozig believed that this has to be a mission of the Jews to bring this knowledge to them. And now we're not just speaking about non-Jews who don't know anything about Judaism or about the Bible, and they're just, because they're good people, follow the seven laws of Noah. We're talking about a conscious recognition that there was a revelation of God to the Israelites, and that for those who are not Jewish, their job is to be Noahides. The Lubavitcher Rebbe started pushing this idea, but Ben Amozig was the first one. Now, he is extremely tolerant, even of Christianity. Even though he points out its errors, he shows himself very tolerant. Listen to this. And now we turn to the followers of the two great messianisms, Christian and Muslim. It is to Christians in particular that we wish to address a frank and respectful word. And God knows that it is with fear in our hearts, lest our advances be taken for hypocrisy. No impartial and reasonable man can fail to recognize and appreciate, as is appropriate, the exalted worth of these two great religions, more especially of Christianity. There is no Jew worthy of his name who does not rejoice in the great transformation wrought by them in a world formerly defiled. He adopts the Rambam's perspective that Christianity has a role to play in this world, that they brought notions of revelation, they brought the Bible to the great parts of the world, they brought morality, all sorts of things, and the fact that they also did terrible crimes against the Jews doesn't take away from his seeing the positive effect they had. As for ourselves, listen to this, we have never had the experience of hearing the Psalms of David on the lips of a priest without feeling such sensations. The reading of certain passages of the Gospels has never left us unresponsive. The simplicity, grandeur, infinite tenderness which these pages breathe out overwhelms us to the depths of our soul. It's found in this book. He hears a priest reciting the Psalms, and that to him is a sign of his universal religion, that the Christian is connecting to the Bible. And rather than that being something pasul, something to keep away from, that to him is beautiful. We all know that Rabbi Lichtenstein got in a lot of trouble when they had these responsive readings of Psalms and things like that. And he said in the passage I read, even the Gospels, which say some wonderful things for the non-Jews. They're not speaking to the Jews, they're speaking to the non-Jews. In fact, Rav Yaakov Emden had a whole theory that the Gospels were written in order to bring non-Jews to a belief in Noahide laws and all these sorts of things. And it was Paul who screwed it up by deifying Jesus. So in a sense, Rav Yaakov Emden is really the predecessor in theory of Ben HaMoses. But Rav Yaakov Emden, as I said, he just wrote this in an obscure Hebrew book. He was not actually involved in trying to make this a reality. His great student, Palier, first Noahide, who we'll get to soon, he writes as follows, speaking about his teacher, Rabbi Ben HaMoses. In the last days of his life, Rabbi Ben HaMoses enjoyed a reclusive retirement in the verdant quarter of Leghorn, when each morning at dawn, bound in tefillin and wrapped in his ample talit, he said his prayers. The sound of the bells in a nearby church reached him with a melodious sweetness, which gave all of nature a religious voice. And it seemed that as he heard this call of Christian bells, the great thinker prayed with a more intense fervor. Ben HaMoses felt in spiritual communion, not only with all his Jewish brethren in all countries, worshiping at the same hour, but also with all believers, spread all over the surface of the earth, who in choosing the first hours of the day for prayer, showed themselves without knowing it to be faithful disciples of the ancient. In Eastern Europe, when you passed a church, you would spit. And Palier speaks about this, so I'll show you soon. And Ben HaMoses sees Christians praying, even though they're making mistakes, they're deifying Jesus, they have their errors, but they're close to Judaism, they're using the Bible. He has this ecumenism, which you'll find in people like Abraham Joshua Heschel, Yitz Greenberg, David Hartman, but is not today what we think of as orthodoxy. But then again, orthodoxy as we know it really comes out of Eastern Europe, to a lesser extent Germany, mostly Eastern Europe, comes out of Lithuania, comes out of the Hasidic movement. It does not come out of Italy. Italian Judaism was such a different Judaism. Italy had the Renaissance, where Vivaldo Sforno was tutored Christians. He had Christian students. Italy was such a very different place. If all of us were now descendants of Italian Jewry, we'd be very different. We might not be great Talmudists, not great poskim, but we'd all be great Hebraists, like the followers of the Ramchal, who wrote poetry and plays. We would be great biblical scholars. We would be very humanistic in our sentiments. So it's really a very different type of Judaism, which I don't know if it exists anymore at all. Because if you go to Italy, even Italian Judaism, the Chabad has moved in, and the rabbis now are trained in Israel. So what was Italian, an ancient tradition even, the Nusach is very ancient, in the last 40 years, I think it is, the old Italian tradition has really disappeared, just like we could say the old German tradition disappeared. Ben HaMoses wants to disabuse people of the notion that Judaism is parochial. And inward-looking. It's not a national cult. He says that. He uses those terms. Judaism, our religion, is a universal religion. It's not just for us. At the heart of Judaism is universal religion, the religion of the human race. People don't realize this. Just, he says, just like a flower, cover the fruit, people look and they only see the flower. They don't see the fruit. So, too, people look at the Torah, they look at the Talmud, and all they see is Judaism. Judaism is the flower, Ben HaMoses says, but the fruit is universal religion. God is not only concerned with a small group. We are the special people, Ben HaMoses explains that. However, God is also concerned with the rest of the world, and the message that he gave to the Jewish people is also intended to be spread from us to the entire world. Ben HaMoses says it is impossible to imagine a situation where the Jewish people exists and the rest of the world is irrelevant. That's not what God's revelation is about. In fact, he goes as far as to say that universal religion is the reason why Judaism has endured, struggled, and suffered. because Judaism as the kingdom of priests have to be inward focused for their people and also outward focused. There are two forms of divine religion, two forms of religion that we have. There's the Judaism encompasses two forms of religion. There's the Mosaic religion practice, and then there's the universal religion in which Judaism provides the information for this universal religion. Quote, far from being obliged to convert the non-Jew to his practices, Israel confines himself to preaching to them the universal religion whose establishment on earth was, in a sense, the purpose of his own existence. Can you imagine? Ben Amozig is saying that our purpose is universal religion. And the way we do this is by, first of all, being good Jews and spreading the word. He takes to say he takes seriously is an understatement. We are here to be metakin olam, tikkun olam, to fix the earth. And we do that by fixing ourselves first. But the reason we fix ourselves is because we have a duty to the entire world. Our door is open to them. Quote, the image of divinity on earth, the partner of the creative spirit is not the Jew, it is man. From a Kabbalistic view, the difference of Jews and non-Jews. Many Kabbalists even speak of as really a separate species, the Jews and the non-Jews. What was until Ben Amozig basically a theoretical notion, that is the Noahide, becomes now the reason for Jewish existence. The Jewish relationship to humanity is at the center of Jewish thought. Now, Ben Amozig, through his great knowledge of the ancient world, saw that there are great similarities between Jewish and ancient practices. That you don't need Ben Amozig to tell you. Just look at the ancient code of Hammurabi and the ancient stories about the flood and other things, and you can look at other practices in the ancient cultures. There are similarities between what the Torah says and what the other cultures say. That's undeniable. The question is, what is a modern scholar? Some modern scholars might say that, well, the Torah has borrowed. So the idea of the Sabbath or kashrus, any of these things are borrowings from ancient. We already know that from a Menozik's perspective, that's not how you look at it. That, remember when I mentioned Chazal speak about the sages, I mean, not the patriarchs observing various laws, that is, intuitively, they know that certain practices, even though they haven't been commanded yet, are what makes for the world the best way to live. And it's not just them, but from them, then these ideas spread out to the entire Near East. So when you see similarities, Judaism, Torah, and in these ancient pagan religions, that's because they come from the same root. And he gives an example. He says, tzitzit. God commands Jews to wear tzitzit. And he points out that, quoting ancient sources, that there was a practice in ancient times to put fringes on the sides of garments. In particular, in Egypt, the priests wore fringes on their garments. Because that is the conception they have, going back to the ancient wisdom, which is really the ancient Kabbalistic wisdom, that fringes are special, and therefore they are put on the garbs of priests. When God commands fringes, he commands it for all Jews, because the Jews are a priestly people. So therefore, whereas for the Egyptians, it's only for the priests, we do it for everyone. This is not borrowing from the Egyptians, although it's the same practice that the Egyptians did. But this is taking it one step further, and this is using what is an ancient practice, an ancient Jewish wisdom practice that predates Har Sinai. It goes back to the dawn of humanity, days of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, who had this knowledge, which then becomes part of the knowledge of the ancient Near East. The Egyptians don't even know where they get it from. They don't know why they do this. They attribute it to their pagan gods and everything. But really, it comes from this divine revelation, this divine wisdom that came down. He says similarly with regard to circumcision. Let me show you the page even. While I'm talking about it, you can see. And when you're looking at this page I'm going to show you now, you can get a sense, I think, of why the book was banned by the rabbis in Aleppo. I mentioned that he quoted non-Jewish authorities. So take a look at this. This is from his commentary on Chumash. Emel Mikra. So here it's on Breishis, and you can see, look at all these ancient sources he's quoting to illuminate things. And if you look over here, I'll just summarize, but where it says, V'chol kohen ha'alilim, hayu malim basaram. Hare shehamila haita siman l'kahuna etzel ha'goyim. He explains here that circumcision, everyone's wondering, where does circumcision come from? That circumcision was a sign for the priests in the ancient Near East. And he brings proofs here from these sources that, and since we are all priests, that's why circumcision is commanded for all of us. So here you see how a knowledge of the ancient Near East illuminates our law. Now we understand why God commands us to be circumcised, because there's something special about circumcision for those who are close to God. And the ancients knew this, which is why they circumcised their priests. But since all of us, all Jews, are close to God, therefore it's for everyone. I mean, he says, "Umizeh keshenit patrak kunat hapratit v'chazri Yisrael liyot kohane olam." Remember the story of Malchit Tzedek? It says, therefore, all of us have to have a brit milah. Ma'ot brit kunat olam. Amazing. He gives so many examples of this. They just printed the HebrewBooks.org, just put online his commentary to Vayikra. So I ordered it. You can order it for like $8. They send you a softcover volume. I show it to you. I have it right here. Get it in like 4 days. So I was reading it over Shabbos. And there's some great stuff in there. There's a lot more great stuff in Bereishis and Shmos. And Vayikra is all about laws. So laws of sacrifices, most people are not going to be attracted to studying that. But still you find amazing things. In chapter 2, verse 11, he just speaks about a verse that everyone passes over, that the meal offering should not have any honey in it. No honey. And in his commentary, he points out that how the ancient pagans viewed honey negatively. And then in their sacrifices, they would sacrifice to the gods of the netherworld, not to the positive gods. That they wouldn't sacrifice to. And he sees this as a parallel to the Torah. We don't believe in the gods of the netherworld, but we also won't use honey in our sacrifice. In other words, this is part of the ancient wisdom of divine revelation. And the ancient pagans, they don't know where they got this from, but they know, they have this tradition, that honey should not be used for the gods. So therefore they use it for the bad gods. And we have this in our Torah. In his commentary, well, I'll skip that. So one more thing. So I mentioned all about paganism here. The last source book I showed, this is, you can see on HebrewBooks.org, Aim La Mikra, his commentary on the Torah, Parshas Vayikra. There's 5 volumes of this commentary. He doesn't condemn paganism. Why doesn't he condemn it? Because he believes that fundamentally, even the ideas of paganism have their roots in this ancient divine wisdom, even in the sephirotic system, the sephirot. It's been distorted completely. Now these pagans, they have different gods and everything, but look at their practices. Practices are the same practices as the Torah's practices, just slightly distorted. And that's the proof of their antiquity. You can see that Abraham had a good relationship with Malchit Tzedek. Malchit Tzedek is a pagan priest. And yet he could do that because they shared certain fundamentals. So when Ben Amozig can look at Christianity and have a good relationship with it, it's because he's looking at the glass half full, not half empty. He states, and listen to this, Israel is only a means, as grand, as noble as you like, but solely a means and not an end in itself. The end resides in the union of Israel and humanity. That sums up the entire providential plan. Everything he sees, various practices of the pagans and the Christians that come out of Judaism, they just need to be corrected a little bit, and then we will have universal religion allied with Judaism. We have our role, and that's for us, and they have universal religion. So he values Christianity in a way that Christianity could never value Judaism. Christianity, at least pre-Vatican II, has this notion of supersessionism. That is, Christianity has now superseded Judaism. Judaism had a role, but now it's been superseded, and it no longer has any value. because religious values are becoming progressively better. And we're left back in the past. Now they're moving forward. Toynbee called us a fossil, if you remember. On the contrary, Ben Amozig looks at Christianity and says, no, you have mistakes. We'll see in his advice to Palier what the mistakes are. The incarnation, turning Jesus into a god, but they have value. They recognize the divine revelation. They recognize various commandments. So that's the positive things. Now, since Ben Amozig is on top of everything going on in the world, you would expect that he would have a response to Darwin. At this very moment, in the late 19th century, Ben Amozig dies in 1900, his ideas were conquering the world. And he does. But before even getting to Darwin, let me tell you that Ben Amozig says explicitly that there is no problem with an ancient universe. A universe that goes back billions of years. In his day, that would have been a very controversial position. Have others, like the Tiferes Yisrael, and write about this, but the standard rabbinic view, this is before, talk about proof of billions of years old, fossils, all this stuff. Ben Amozig is already saying that this is not an issue for us. He says that the first day of the Hebrew calendar is not Sunday, the first day of creation, Shabbos Bereishis. Everything before that seventh day, where God rests, is not history in the normal sense. Meta history. It's not history. These are not days. How can there be days? The sun's not created to the third day. These are eras of God's creative will, and we have no idea how long that was or how it happened. Everything only begins at the end, on the seventh day. Now, Ben Amozig actually writes in opposition to evolution, but not in the sense that humanity developed. That he's not really concerned with. He's not arguing for a fundamentalist literalism, as I just said. What he's arguing against in terms of evolution is the idea of Darwin of randomness. That is, that God is no longer a picture. Natural selection can explain everything. And Amozig's point is, and Shem Shachar Hirsch would agree with this, is that evolution is fine, but it has to be divinely guided. That is, you can speak about a slow development of man, but it has to be divinely guided. Scientific evolution is that it's all random. So that Ben Amozig would not accept. This has nothing to do with whether you teach in the school or anything, just like you can't speak about miracles or God. History course, say, well, then God, this, America won the war because God was on their side, so you can't do that in history. But as a religious person, he says, you have to recognize that this was all set in place by God and guided by God, even if there's no evidence of this. Can't point to evidence, say, well, it developed this way because of God. No, but whatever did develop, that's as much divine providence as anything else that happens in our life. That's our belief, he says. So in that sense, he opposes evolution. I mean, and he says that now we know there's no such thing as spontaneous generation, abiogenesis, that things are created spontaneously, which was a common ancient belief, that flies or maggots would come out of dirt or sweat. In fact, there's halachot that depend on this. According to the halacha, you can kill lice on Shabbos because lice spontaneously generate. Now that we know that's not true, it's a big machlokes already in the 16th century in the Pachad Yitzchak, which is an Italian sefer, halacha encyclopedia. You have a dispute there. Can we kill lice today? Because now we know that they don't spontaneously generate. And this dispute continues to our own day. Hafach thought that today cannot kill lice on Shabbos. Another rabbi say, no, it doesn't matter what science tells us. We have to stick with the halacha as it is. The whole dispute over the fish dispute over these bugs, the little worms in fish, goes back to this issue because all the rabbis who are permitting these worms say that they're permitted because they spontaneously generate in the fish. And ironically, it's someone like Ramosha Sternbach, who's as far right as you can get from the Eda Haredit, says that this is nonsense, that nature has changed, and right now nothing spontaneously is generating. The scientists can show you how the worms get into the fish, and therefore you cannot eat these fish. I think most people listening to us now would not accept the idea that nature has changed. They would have the idea that the rabbis who spoke about spontaneous generation were simply repeating mistaken scientific facts of their time. But I think it is significant that you have people who work for the OU. I can show you a guy, Rabbi, works for the OU, who published a long piece when this whole worm controversy came out, saying that it's basic to Judaism that you believe in spontaneous generation despite what science says. And I'm going to be writing on the Sfarim blog about this because, I mean, once Orthodox Jews, to be an Orthodox Jew, you have to believe in spontaneous generation. We're really in a different world now, a different dimension. I'm not talking about billion-year-old world that you can maybe speculate and say, okay, well, God created the world to look old, that sort of thing. Spontaneous generation is something that you can show in every laboratory in the world that it doesn't take place. We're talking about something that can be shown empirically to anyone. I don't know what to say about that. Rabbi Belsky, he's an interesting case because he can't admit that the rabbis would ever make a mistake, so therefore he says that Gemaras and the Rishoni, when the Gemaras speak about spontaneous generation, they're not really speaking about it. He reinterprets it. No one in history has ever said that it means that. Everyone assumes, every Rishon, every Acharon, and if you look at the Talmud, they speak about spontaneous generation. So you're stuck with either saying the Chazal were wrong, but the Halacha either stays the same or changes, or that if you say Chazal can't be wrong, then either you hold that there is spontaneous generation or that it means something else. Some people have tried to say that Chazal were speaking about things that we can see. And since this it takes place so minuscule that we can't really see it, that they don't consider that giving birth in the normal sense. But the people who've written on it say that that doesn't really make sense from the texts. So that's a big dispute, this spontaneous generation issue. There are many people who say that even if Chazal were wrong, the halacha doesn't change. Therefore, you can eat these worms. Rabbi Akiva can eat these worms. If Moshe Feinstein ate these worms, you don't change the halacha. But as I said, there are people who say that we should change the halacha now and worms to place. So what does this have to do with Ben Amozig? Because he says now that we know there's no spontaneous generation, what is Darwin talking about when he speaks about human life just developing on its own? And, Darwin himself spoke about life that develops from phosphorus salt and light and heat. Today they speak of, what do they call it, the prebiotic soup or something like that. You had these chemicals that existed that over time formed molecular chains, and this led to primitive life. Ben Amozig says this is nonsense. If you, the scientists, are telling us that he knew science, he knew 19th century science, which is not our science, but he knew science very well, if you're telling us, and if you prove to us, because spontaneous generation had been proven at that by that time, that you can have spontaneous generation, life cannot just emerge on its own, how then, on the other hand, can you speak about human life on Earth just developing from non-life forms? How can phosphoric salt become life? And if you are going to say that's how it happens, well, why only one species or two species, which then develop into many? Why not immediately a million species? So he rejects the whole notion of a spontaneous creation of life, which I think, other than the great scientists, I don't know how many people can really accept something like this, that and not just some of these scientists who are so quick to remove God, and assert that life can be created out of nothing. But in terms of the idea of evolution, of humanity developing, he is very much together with Rav Kook, that this is in accord with Jewish views. We are moving, he believes, in the direction of a new spiritual world where man will be at a higher spiritual level. And he uses Midrashic passages, the famous ones that speak about God creating and destroying worlds that everyone cites to justify religiously the idea of an ancient universe. He uses the Kabbalistic idea of the sabbatical years, the Shemitot. And that's him and Darwin. I now want to speak a bit about his book, Jewish and Christian Ethics, which is really a comparison. I mentioned this book already. Right in the front, you can maybe see it. It says, this was published by one of these Kirov organizations, Haredi Kirov organizations, called the Jewish Heritage and Roots Library, the Kess Leibowitz Library. And on the back it says, the truth about the distortions and lies that Christians missionaries use to win over the unknowing Jew. Truthfully, this book has nothing to do with Christian missionaries. It's not about refuting Christianity. And on the back it says, the only Jew who is easy prey for Christian missionaries is one ignorant of his own rich heritage, This important book, a reprint from 1873, reveals the truth about the Christian hard sell of distortions and outright lies used to win over the unknowing Jewish soul. And as I said, this is complete nonsense. The book has nothing to do with missionaries or winning over Jewish souls or anything like that. It has nothing to do with the Christian hard sell of distortions and outright lies. It does point out defects, he thinks, in Christianity. So if you're thinking of converting and you read it, you'll see that, well, Judaism is better than Christianity. That's his point, that Judaism, the Christians are saying that Christianity is better than Judaism. Judaism's been passed by, and he's saying that, no, Christianity is better, that Jewish ethics are really better than Christian ethics. But this has nothing to do with the description we saw here. What is the book? It's an analysis of the Jewish and Christian view of the world, showing the negative effects of Christian doctrine and the positive effects and the superiority of Jewish teachings. I still think it's amazing that a Haredi group decided to reprint Ben Amozig, because if there's, of all the figures we've done, Ben Amozig, I guess, is together with Eliezer Berkowitz and maybe a couple others, who is really the anti-Haredi. His whole philosophy is anti-Haredi, including in this book. Yeah, he's criticizing Christianity, but at the same time, he doesn't hesitate to say the good things about Christianity. Yeah. He admires the merits of Christianity and sees it, as Maimonides does, as a step on the way to the Messianic era. But on the whole, his judgment is negative. And he points out that, why is he doing this book, comparing Jewish and Christian ethics? He wouldn't do it on his own. He has no interest in telling how bad Christianity is for the sake of doing it. But he says Christianity invited the comparison because they made their own comparison, contrasting negatively Mosaic ethics with the ethics of Jesus, and arguing that the Jesus ethics are a more advanced stage and the Mosaic ethics are from a primitive stage. And therefore, he's going to show just the opposite, that Mosaic ethics are superior to Christian ethics. It's obviously incumbent upon Jews, when their ethical system is attacked in the way it is, to respond. You can find this book on Google Books. For some reason, they only included because they use this as an anti-missionary tract, they don't have here the second half of the book. The original book is titled Jewish versus Christian and Mohammedan. Today we don't refer to Mohammedans because they don't worship Muhammad. We refer to Muslims. But he also goes off against Islam as well. Much shorter, but he does. On page 4, writes, "Now, what has Christianity substituted for the God of the Jews, the first and the last, the author of the beginning and end of man and the world? It has ascribed progression to God itself, at least in its external word, asserting that this last bends to circumstances, to customs, even to the weakness of man." In other words, he speaks about how Christianity thinks God changes. First he gives the Torah, and now he has to come. He gives a more advanced Torah, the Gospel. On page 7, he's very interesting. I'm not going to read it, but Christians were arguing that the Christian idea of turn the other cheek is superior to any form of Jewish ethics. And Ben Amozig says this is ridiculous. Turn the other cheek is said to individuals. It's not said to nations. And the nations, the Christian church, never assumed it was said to nations. And he says you're comparing individuals who choose to turn the other cheek to the Jewish community. Jewish ethics are communal ethics. They're not just for individuals. They're for the people as a whole. So the comparison doesn't work. On page 10 to 11, he criticizes Christianity for the cruelty carried out in its name. And he points out that the worst thing Christianity ever did, or one of the worst things, was joining religion and state in Christendom. That led to burning heretics at the stake and all sorts of massacres and terrible things. He speaks about how Judaism has never been interested in punishing heretics, but rather in teaching them and bringing them to repentance. But I wonder, is that true? I don't think so. But that's what Ben Amozig says. Listen to this. "Never was remorse supplanted by the scaffold or held by death. No civil penalty for impiety and no spiritual burden for the citizen. It had a code, solely politic, the law of Moses, and a code, solely religious tradition." His argument is that with our heretics, without our sinners, we try to bring them back with love, the teaching. Whereas what does the Christian church do? They burn them at the stake, they execute them, they do all these things. Historically, he might be correct in that if you look back at Second Temple times, the rabbis were never burning heretics. We were never doing these things. It was sort of like a live and let live. The Pharisees did their thing, the Sadducees did their things, and yet, if you look in the codes, the Rambam and other places, they write that we should kill the heretics. So, I think maybe he's not being completely frank with his reader. This is a book published in the vernacular, not in Hebrew. Because, and this might be what Ben Amozig wants, a society where we don't punish heretics, but we try to bring them close. And in our own society today, that's what we do. We try to bring them close. But I think it's a little disingenuous just to make the case the way he does, because the fact is that if the Rambam was running the show, very much like Christendom. And they did punish. They punished Spinoza, okay. They didn't execute him. They didn't do things like that. But if they could have executed Spinoza, they probably would have executed Spinoza. But that's his argument. I think that at best we can say he is arguing for what he thinks Judaism should be like, and very much like Mendelssohn. Mendelssohn, in his book Jerusalem, also argues that we should not be interested in punishing people for religious crimes. Later in this book, he speaks about the Christian rejection of the body and makes a very interesting case. You had all these early Christian sects, or at least some Christian sects, that were addicted to sensuality. You know, various sexual practices, and that, what sense does that make? It should just be the opposite, you think of it. He argues that Christianity early on adopts this Greek notion of the body as impure. So if you want to become spiritual, you have to reject the body. And therefore, what happens the way he, in his portrayal, there's Ben Amozig's, they ended up speaking about how terrible the body was, how it was useless, how it's apart from us. The only thing that matters is the spirit. And if you reach the point when you have no concern for the physical, when it has no significance, well, then basically you can do whatever you want with the physical. Because you've reached the stage where you've convinced yourself that the only thing that matters is the spirit. The physicality is irrelevant. It has no connection to who you are and where you're going in heaven and everything. So therefore, if the body means nothing, well, what you do with the body also means nothing. And you can engage in all sorts of depraved abominations, sexual abominations. It doesn't matter because the body doesn't affect the soul. The only thing that matters is the soul. So ironically, Ben Amozig says, the very religion that argued that we have to remove ourselves from the body, that the body is what hurts the spirit, ends up abusing the body. And if we want to use modern terminology, we could say that those who do not live in accordance with the physical world, we have physical needs and we're supposed to be physical, sexual, will end up screwed up. And that's exactly what he says. He says Christianity screwed up themselves because they did not recognize that the body is also a gift from God, and that there needs to be a unification, as Kabbalah speaks about, of the physical and the spiritual. I think it's an amazing insight in explaining how it is that the early Christian sects ended up going into really become libertines. Listen to this passage. Life, health, riches, science, honor, glory, love, family, country, all that make existence great, holy, and happy. These reflections of heaven below. All these things are reflections of heaven. These foretastes of eternity were vilified, spurned, and sacrificed so that prospective life, that is, the kingdom not of this world, but of the next world, were all swept away by the same torrent that bore off into the region of dogma, whatever had value and position. He argues that Christianity took everything that's valuable. Health, riches, money too. They don't like money. They say that we believe we have money. You can do tzedakah. You can do great things. They say it's harder to get into heaven if you're rich than the camel through the eye of a needle. Honor, glory, love, family, all the important things, they said are meaningless. If this asceticism that Christianity developed ended up being very destructive. That's what he argues there. I will say, and I found this very disappointing, bad enough what these people did when they describe the book, but I'm reading it, and all of a sudden, I get to changes in font. I don't know if you could see this. You probably can't see it so well. You can't really see. I'm wondering, what's the changes with the fonts here? You know, you have one type of font and then a different font, and then you have big spaces. So I go on Google Books, and I see the original, and lo and behold, this book has been censored in order to accord with Haredi sensibilities. And they do this all the time, but what they censored is quite interesting, and I see it's already 10 o'clock, so I'll get to that next time, but what we still need to do, we will finish Ben HaMozig within the first 20 minutes of next class, is a few more things about Ben HaMozig. His idea of a haftar recha kamocha, love thy neighbor as thyself, which includes non-Jews, he thinks. Rabbi Zaini from Haifa, who's his great admirer, and who has published, he published this book in Hebrew, Musar Yehudi Lumat Musar Notzri. He goes crazy about this this passage, so we'll talk about it, and a couple other things, and then I want to move into briefly tell you the story about Pellier. First, Noachide. Noachide, who wore talus and tefillin. And just tell you, for those who like spiritual biographies, this book is great, The Unknown Sanctuary. But as I said, the only Noachide that I know of, and the story of how he became a Noachide, instead of becoming a Catholic priest, and how he came under Ben HaMozig's wing, and how he wants to convert to Judaism and become a rabbi, and Ben HaMozig, and then Ben HaMozig's successor, convince him not to become a rabbi. That his job, if he became a rabbi, he'd have a small shtela, he'd influence a few people, but now he can influence the world. Brought to universal religion. This is an incredible story. And that's what we will do next class, and then we will begin, I believe, with Rabbi Yosef Nassas. So we will end here. I said a lot, I spoke quickly, so let me answer your comments. Someone asks me, yes, divine revelation, starts at the dawn of history. Yes, Abraham had divine revelation. Isaac, Adam, Noah. And their divine revelation contains ideas about sacrifices, about various mitzvot, and then these seep in to society as a whole. Because as Ben HaMozig says, Abraham is a great man. Everyone came to Abraham, and they saw how Abraham lived. And that's how he explains similarities in practices in Torah, and other cultures. And therefore, to say that we can understand why we have circumcision by looking at the Egyptian practice of circumcision for the rabbis in Aleppo, that's like a heretical statement. You're going to explain God's will in the Torah because we see what the Egyptians are doing? But for Ben HaMozig, it makes perfect sense. The Egyptians are reflecting the old divine wisdom that circumcision is something for those people who are holy, connected to God. Now we understand why all Jews are given it, not just the Kohanim, because we are holy to God. And this is part of the original plan of God. Can I source the quote from the Chasam Sofer? Which quote? Oh, the quote about the Zohar. I have a very long article that's going to appear soon about the Zohar and how Achronim viewed it, and I have it there. But if you want to know it, it's one of his Talmidim quoted it. If you tell me, I'll give you the exact citation. Dr. Gewirtz's classes are standalone in the sense that each class deals with a separate unit and he actually finished what he was doing. However, I would recommend those who want to hear it to listen to the last ones, but you can understand it. That it doesn't continue. He's not, he didn't say we'll pick up with this point. It's going to be a new discussion, but obviously dependent to a certain extent previously, so I'd recommend listening to it. That's what he says, sort of. But it's not like me, where I don't end. I just continue, and we could stop with 15 minutes to go. He was careful to end it. You say, how did he get away with anti-Christian comments? When he's writing in the end of the 19th century, the church, what he's saying is nothing compared to what Christians are saying about the church. Do you know that there was a strong anti-clerical sentiment in Italy? You had people who fought against the Vatican. There was the Vatican lost control during his lifetime of large sections of Italy. The Italian people did not want to be controlled by the Vatican. The Vatican was a political power, so you had all sorts of opponents of Christianity in Italy itself, anti-clerical people. So it's not like he's living under papal rule or under evil Christian rule. Say whatever you want to say. In his day, you had atheists, communists, or proto-communists. You had all sorts of people. You had people who believed, the spiritists who believed in ancient pagan religion. Even today, by the way, Italy, the cradle of Western civilization, if you go, when they had an abortion bill in Italy, it passed no problem. Same thing in Poland. We're the most religious Christian country, America. These countries are Catholic in name only. You go to even Italy, who goes to church there? The numbers are minuscule. That's not an issue. Some more comments before we stop. This book by Pallier is called, Pallier, The Unknown Sanctuary, A Pilgrimage from Rome to Israel. He was training to be a priest. How does he deal with the anti-Gentile talk in the Gemara? Pallier actually deals with it a little bit. His perspective is that, I guess the same as the Meiri, that these are the wicked pagans of old, the evil people. That's what the Gemara is speaking about, not the good people. These are not passages meant to be generalized. That's his perspective on it. He doesn't go into it in as great as detail as I would like, because these are books directed against Gentiles, but his basic understanding is that these are not the general view of how we relate to the non-Jews. This is how we relate to the evil non-Jews, but not non-Jews as a whole. And evil for him are not idolaters. Those are just people who are mistaken. Evil to him are wicked people. They were also idolaters, but they're wicked. I will show you next class what he says about how we have to love even the idolater. Rabbi Zaini goes crazy about that. Even though Ben Amozig quotes Rav Chaim Vital as saying that, I'll show you what Zaini says, that this only applies to the greatest tzaddikim, not for the masses. But we'll get into that next class. Were there halachic ramifications? It's a good question. I don't know. Because the only halachic work he ever published, and it was published posthumously, was his work on cremation. We would have to get testimony from someone from his community in Italy, incidentally, many people did drink Gentile wine, and there were rabbis who permitted it. I'm not talking about in his day. I don't know what was done in his day. But 200 years before, in the 1700s, you had big rabbis. Rosh HaRabbanim, the chief rabbi of Venice, permitted drinking Gentile wine. And you had other people in Italy. I don't know Ben Amozig's view on that matter at all, or any of the other anti-Gentile things. He did not write halachic works. The only way you would know this is if you lived in Livorno and he gave a psak. He functioned as a rav and as an abbasin, but he didn't write this, so I really don't know. Okay, everyone, we will meet, God willing, next Monday. That'll be our fourth class on Ben Amozig, and I fully anticipate to finish Ben Amozig then, and I hope at that point I'll be able to respond to some more of your comments, show you some very interesting things, including from Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski's new book that came out, his letters, really fits in well with what we did last semester. Okay, thank you very much, everyone, and have a good week.